Welcome to the Calder Farmstead.
Now the Icehawks back out to center in transition. Carlson with Quenneville 2-on-1. Right wing Carlson from the Quenneville scores.
Here to chance for Perrin.
Five scores! On the faceoff!
Up it's Emminger. Go back to Werenski. Has it. Shoots one. Bounces off a man. 5 seconds left. Werenski. Another jam on the shot. Turning and firing.
It's gone in overtime. The Bears breaking out. Right side with Bear. Looks like cutting to the net. Bear will score!
And here are your hosts, CeCe and Sean.
Hello and greetings from the Mile High City of Denver, Colorado.
And Northville, Michigan.
Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, episode number 97 for Tuesday, April 12th, 2022. If you're hoping for a podcast featuring tips on barn spring cleanings, we are not going to be much help. This is an American Hockey League podcast, and my name is CeCe Hockley, the AHL editor of Full Press Hockey.
And I'm Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And I know he absolutely loves when I say this, but he's kind of a big deal.
Nope.
And as always, thank you for tuning in with us. We really appreciate it.
And if you're new to hearing CeCe and I talk about hockey, we're going to recap some of the matchups in the AHL from the past weekend for you. We both watch a lot of AHL games. We're going to start and are going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break it down. If that's new to you, you may want to head over to our podcast feed or YouTube channel, wherever you're listening to us from, and scroll all the way to the bottom there and check out episode 0. It's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're newer to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer hockey terms like controlled zone entries, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes. And let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes thinking you could buy a Josh Allen rookie card. You'll never get that time back. So next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey?
So why would I think I could buy a Josh Allen rookie card?
Because it's a 2-inch by 4-inch piece of cardboard paper with Josh Allen's face printed on it. That's it. Shouldn't be that expensive.
It shouldn't, but yeah, the trading card industry. It is.
Yeah. If you ever get a chance, look up Greater Fool Financial Theory. That's the baseball.
Greater Fool Financial Theory?
Yes.
Okay.
That is what trading cards, Beanie Babies, crypto. That's what all of it is.
Gotcha. Dark Side of the 90s, the Beanie Babies episode is quite enlightening. So check that out if you can. But anyway, foolish endeavors aside, let's talk about the weekend that was the pick'ems. We always start with that. So let's get to it. Human error admission on my part and omission on my part. I forgot to put down the Lehigh Valley versus Bridgeport matchup for Sunday. So, yeah, just hang me up by my pinky toes and beat me with a wet noodle, I suppose. But I think that's how the phrase goes. Anyway, remember how Sean and the model were exactly the same last weekend? It's my turn. The model and I go 20 for 31 this weekend. That's a 64.5% correct pick rate. Sean didn't fare so well. We had enough variance where he was picking 14 of 31 games correctly. That's 45.2%. The model, of course, leads the overall weekend picks, 56.4%. It just keeps getting better as the season winds down. And then Sean actually has had three pick'ems more than me because of episodes where Courtney has filled in, Paige has filled in. So he's at 53.5%. I am at 52.4%. So even though I'm 8-6 overall against Sean is leading me in the points pick percentage. So if it comes down to that, I think I'm just going to count it as a wash for the year and we'll just call it good.
All right.
Yeah. No complaints.
I mean, I have a title belt being fashioned and everything, but it's fine. You know, we'll tie.
Sean's not competitive at all, right? I was just kind of, wanting to extend a little olive branch, but he's going to go world champion over here with the title belt and everything. Macho CeCe loves it. He'll come out later in the show. Let's get to it. Again, recapping the weekend it was. that was. We're going to start in the Atlantic Division like we always do. Wilkes-Barre-Scranton, not a series, but a game, and we wanted to give the Baby Pen some love. So Saturday at 7 p.m. against the Syracuse Crunch. And Sean, who, after a 9-2 victory, we thought that this was going to be a goal fest. Do you need to take a deep breath, maybe a drink of water for this one?
Nope, one goal. Nick Perbix beats Jonathan Gruden to a rim around the defensive zone. The Crunch continue to work the cycle. Perbix skates below the goal line, has one pass the slot blocked, but recovers the puck, goes behind the net, and finds Jemel Smith on the back door for the tap-in. 1-0 Crunch under 3 minutes into the second period. Those would be all the goals that were counted. The Crunch hold on to win 1-0.
Oh, a little foreshadowing there, maybe? All right, let's get to our picks in this game. And I said the Crunch would defeat the Baby Pens. Sean, you said that the model does not take rest and travel into account yet. And as you just said, Syracuse was, not as you just said last episode, Syracuse is playing its third game in 4 days. Wilkes-Barre-Scranton had 2 days off. How much is that worth? You thought it was enough to tip the scale, and you picked the Penguins. The model picked Syracuse, 58.3% favorite, and me and the model, like we were pretty much all weekend long, we were in cahoots. So the Crunch, take it. And yeah, we have one goal that you recapped, but we've got a lot more in between, in the front and back of that. Sean, we talked about the Penguins power play in the preview, and you said you weren't sure if they were doing something innovative and failing or doing something dumb and succeeding. Again, it was a really unique setup that you described to the listeners last time. Has another viewing cleared that up for you?
I think so. I'm pretty sure they're doing something dumb and succeeding. They really seem to be only using that shift of having two players on the blue line to have that one like set play where they drive that far side, weak side player downhill with the puck and they shoot. And again, it's something I've seen other teams do in shades of. Texas, for example, does it with Anthony Lewis, where they have him kind of swing in and come downhill in that. But the difference is those players and those teams that do it have other, they complement that play with other dangerous options that, you know, that guy coming down the wing can do. So the goalie can't just anchor on the shooter. He has to consider, you know, the pass or other aspects of the play instead of just this guy is going to come down and shoot and I can just stare him down and make the save. That's not working for the Penguins, and the rest of the power play is not doing much of anything in terms of creating dangerous chances. They are focusing a lot on just looking for shooting lanes from distance and hoping to get greasy goals, which is not an effective way of creating offense. A thing we've said time and time again, but the proof is in the pudding here. They're one of the worst power plays in the league consistently because that seems to be their focus. Normally I'd lay the blame on the coaching staff here, but I actually learned something about Wilkes-Barre-Scranton this weekend. They have the smallest coaching staff in the AHL. One assistant coach, one head coach, no goalie coach listed. So it's not as surprising their special teams aren't very good, as most of the time one assistant coach runs the penalty kill, one assistant coach runs the power play, one coaches the forwards, one coaches the D. So the fact that they have, you know, half of the manpower that a regular staff has, which would be one head coach, two assistants, and a goalie coach, they don't have a goalie coach. They have one head coach and assistant. So the fact that, like, their special teams are kind of falling short this season probably is in respect to that. So that's probably a big problem with why Wilkes-Barre-Scranton's power play has been just a gong show and their penalty kill has also not been good. It's because they just don't have the manpower to work through all of the work they would have to do, you know, with video meetings and strategizing and, you know, working that out with players. Like, there's only two of them to do what is now a four-person job, basically. And it's, even with four people, like, it's still asking a lot and doing a lot and very demanding. Professional hockey is becoming more and more specialized and cutthroat. And to have, you know, two hands tied behind your back to try and make it work, shockingly, it's not going too well.
Yeah, I mean, that's ECHL level stuff right there. And even some ECHL teams, you know, staff more coaches than that. So it's just
a handful, yeah. Not like, I don't think there are too many ECHL teams with a goalie coach.
No.
But as far as I know, Wilkes-Barre-Scranton is the only team that doesn't have a goalie coach. And other teams are a little short-staffed too, but they're ones that, like, in Rockford, where they had their head coach and assistant coach you know, go to the NHL for a fired to take over a fired position. So the fact that they're short isn't like an intentional display. It was something they just kind of had to work through this season. Whereas like Wilkes-Barre-Scranton started the season with two coaches. This was the plan. And that's real dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. Another instance, Bakersfield with Colin Chalk, as the interim head coach, you know, obviously that's going to happen and you're going to have guys call up and you have to bring other guys in. So, but
yeah. And if memory serves me, I think they had two guys for a short period of time, but then they filled in those, like they have like someone like guest assistant coaching. I don't remember who it is, but I remember it being like
AHL Hall of Famer, I believe.
Yes. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Yeah. But anyway, that's getting to Bakersfield. Let's stick to Wilkes-Barre-Scranton.
Yes. My apologies. I saw Bakersfield in Colorado, so my head's kind of there.
No worries.
From Friday night. So no worries. All right. This game was 1-0. You kind of alluded to the goal that counted. So how did the Crunch take away this game just by one goal? Just one goal scored between all teams?
I mean, for starters, it should have been 2-0. Gage Gonsalves had a puck deflected off his elbow and going to the net. It somehow got waved off immediately, and that's not allowed to be video reviewed according to AHL Rule 79.3. I looked it up because this was not the only disallowed or allowed goal that was controversial this week. So I learned a lot about what the AHL allows with video review, which is wild, and we'll get to that later. But it's in short, that's a ridiculous rule and needs to be changed. But again, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But to answer your question of how the Crunch came away with this 1-1, Max Lagasse stole this game for the Crunch flat out. I'd say he was out for revenge against his former team, but he's on his fifth AHL team, so probably not as big a motivating factor as it would be for some others. Wilkes-Barre-Scranton straight dominated possession. They dominated scoring chances for the majority of this game, but flat out could not put one past Max Lagasse, who was, for the most part, on it. Like, this was not a Wilkes-Barre-Scranton failing to, you know, put obvious scoring chances in the back of the net. This was, by and large, Max Lagasse playing out of his mind.
Aside from Lagasse, who stood out to you at a player level in this game?
From the Wilkes-Barre-Scranton side here, P.O. Joseph definitely did. Both in good and bad ways. Decision-making, awareness, attention to detail on the defensive side for P.O. Joseph continue to plague his game, and probably why he continues to be in a Wilkes-Barre-Scranton Penguins uniform and not a Pittsburgh Penguins uniform. Definitely a lot of moments in which he made questionable decisions, you know, in the neutral zone, lost awareness and had guys go blowing past him in the neutral zone that he should have been paying attention to. Couple of questionable decisions on breakouts, one in which he saucered a pass from behind the net directly in front of the net during, you know, while pressure on the forecheck was coming that predictably did not go well. But still, P.O. Joseph is such a big part of generating offense for that team. He drives the weak side on rush chances. He's making zone entries and, you know, pressing on the forecheck because he's up with the play. He acts as a fourth forward coming through the neutral zone repeatedly. He's activating off the blue line and making offense that way. So he is still a dynamic part of this team and making goals happen sometimes for whoever has the puck, which not ideal, but something that can be worked on. But still good offensive things from P.O. Joseph this weekend, some questionable defensive things from him. On the less positive side, Casper Bjorkqvist really just floating around everywhere in this game. So much in transition, like just kind of skating around like he bought a ticket and is watching. Nowhere to be found on breakouts, oftentimes led to turnovers on rim arounds where he was supposed to be on the half wall and was already, you know, halfway across the center ice red line. Just a lot of really soft board play from him and a lot of just nonsensical, not where he's supposed to be on structured moments in the offense, and not a good week or not a good game from him. Drew O'Connor, the other one, good moments and bad ones, definitely generated offense, had scoring chances for the Baby Pens, but also had some head scratches on his decision-making, including one in the middle of the first period where he got locked into trying to make a pass and trying to wait for a sprawling defender to kind of go sliding by him on like a little miniature 2-on-1 from like the face-off circles down. And as he's waiting for this defender to go sliding by so he can make the pass over him, he completely missed the fact that like Lagasse gave him the top half of the net to shoot at as he was kind of sprawled post to post and had like the bottom covered, but there was literally half of the net up top to shoot at. But Drew O'Connor locked into making this pass and watching the defender, wasn't watching the net. Overall, I think he played a fine game. He was a force for good for Wilkes-Barre Scranton in terms of creating offense, being reasonably responsible on defense, making good plays, but a couple moments that just, if you want to see progress from him, you need to see him make better decisions in those big key moments, like that one where he could have scored in a game that was decided by one goal.
All right. Looking ahead for Wilkes-Barre Scranton, I'm looking here at the standings currently. They're fifth in the Atlantic Division. They've got 9 games remaining. Hartford has 6 games remaining in 6th place. Bridgeport has 4 games remaining. So, and then Lehigh Valley has 10. I mean, what a disparity between those 4 teams and the games remaining. Needless to say, Wilkes-Barre Scranton might have their work cut out for them. What lays ahead for them on the horizon, Shawnee?
They have the second worst schedule for a week that you can have in the AHL. That is a Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, 3-3 against 3 different teams. The worst, obviously, is a 3-3 against 3 different teams. So second, the penultimate in crappy schedule. Wednesday is against the Charlotte Checkers. Charlotte is 5-2 against the Penguins this season. And the Checkers are 8-2 in their last 10 and won 5 of their last 6. So, that's never a good thing to be going up against not only a team that you have struggled with this season, but is also red hot. Friday is their penultimate showdown with the Hershey Bears, who also have been very good against Wilkes-Barre Scranton. The Bears are 8-2 in their 10 games against Wilkes-Barre this season. Hershey is struggling a bit, 4-6 in their last 10, but just took a weekend sweep of Springfield this past weekend. So kind of hard to get a measure on them. Saturday is their last game against the Bridgeport Sound Tigers. Bridgeport is 2-3 against Wilkes-Barre Scranton this year, but will be looking for revenge after that 9-2 thrashing from earlier in the month. The Sound Tigers are 6-4 in their last 10 games. So not only a difficult 3-4 against 3 separate teams, but teams that maybe they don't want to be playing out of the 3 if they had to pick. So a rough go of it here for Wilkes-Barre Scranton coming up.
And an odd note that I pointed out on social media about Charlotte, the wacky AHL schedule, Charlotte clinched a playoff spot when they were second in the Atlantic Division. They're first now, but it showed up as second. And it's like, oh yeah, we still have games remaining and everything like that, points percentage to get worked out. But yeah, Charlotte was second in the Atlantic and they were the first team in the Atlantic to clinch a playoff spot.
I mean, it was weird, but when, like, after you looked at it for a second, like, oh, right, because they have a lower floor of what their points percentage could be because they have so few games remaining compared to everyone else. It's like, oh, yeah. But then I, like, the amount of people were like, but they're second. How did they? I'm like, it's just math, guys. Like, it's not even hard math, but
okay. It's just math, and it was just a visual oddity that I pointed out. Yeah,
and then like literally the next day, I really wish Charlotte would have, like, their social media person would have, like, quote tweet dunked on a bunch of people after they got into first place the very next day. Mm-hmm. It's been like, don't worry, we fixed it for you guys.
Relax, R-E-L-A-X, relax.
Yeah. All right, Cece, do you want to take us to break there?
I can. Yeah. So, apparently we got to run some ads and keep the lights on, keep the show going, bring Sean back from the Canadian border into Michigan there. Did you check out the Upper Peninsula? No. Okay.
I did not. No.
Okay. Just thought I'd ask. Anyway. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're going to get to the Utica Comets. And if you're just here for Wilkes-Barre Scranton, we thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you can get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. Links to our social media and more can be found at our Linktree page at linktr.ee/thecalderfarmstead. We do the memes. We do the graphs. We do all the visual aids to keep you engaged with the American Hockey League. We're going to pay some bills. Again, Sean's off in Michigan, so he's got to get those Canadian bucks transferred to American bucks if he hasn't done so already. Stay tuned.
And welcome back from break. We are here to talk about the Utica Comets. They had 2 games this weekend, a Friday game at Belleville, a Saturday game in Laval, Canadian road trip for them. CeCe, goals were scored in this one. Tell me about them.
A lot more than the 1-0 endeavor that Wilkes-Barre Scranton had against the Crunch. So let's get to it. Friday versus Belleville. Colby Williams takes a slap shot from above the right wing circle. Utica goalie Merrick Smittens paddles it away across the boards to the left wing. Jake Lucchini snaps it back on net right quick, and Andrew Agazino deflects it into the net past Mittens. Belleville on the board first at 2:18 of the first. Maxence Gannett wrists a puck on net. net. That's put aside by Mittens. Scott Sabourin recovers the rebound behind the net, passes it back to Gannett. Gannett tries another wrister and succeeds this time. Top shelf, 2-0 BCens at 2:39 of the first. Mere moments later, Zach Leslie takes a shot from the blue line. Mittens makes the initial save, but the puck dribbles out from behind him. Lucchini taps the puck in, and you have a 3-0 Belleville lead at 4:58 of period number one. Akira Schmid comes in as Mittens allows those three goals on just six shots. On the first power play of the game, Logan Shaw zips it cross ice to Jonathan Aspero for a quick wrister and a score. 4-0 Belleville at 8:18 of the first regulation frame. That's four goals in about 8 minutes' time. The only other goal of this game came in the second period from the Utica Comets. Off of a Belleville turnover behind the net of Philip Gustafson, forward Tyler Irvine wrangled possession and tucked the puck in backhand before Gus could get to the opposite side of the net. It's kind of a weird, freaky play, just a turnover behind the net. Shutout ruined for Gus at 12:41 of the second, but that would be your final score on the evening. 4-1, Belleville takes it against Utica. Saturday against Laval, now to the goals. Utica starts us off. Tyce Thompson finds himself below the Laval goal line and backhands a pass to awaiting Alexander Holtz on the doorstep. Holtz one-times it from his knee by Rocket goalie Caden Primo. 1-0 Comets at 7:23 of the first. On a power play shortly after, Riley Walsh passes it to Holtz along the blue line. Holtz puts a shot on net, which Ryan Schmelzer deflects by Primo to make it 2-0 Utica at 9:20 of period one. Just over a minute of gameplay later, Michael Vukojevic feeds a pass over to Nolan Foote for a slap shot one-timer, another one by Primo, and the Comets have shot out to a 3-0 lead at 9:20 of period numero uno. So 3-0 lead for the Comets. Another minute of gameplay, and Laval says, enough. The Rocket caused a turnover in the Utica end via a Nate Schar interception, former Comets player, traded over to Montreal at the deadline. He passes to Joel Teasdale all alone in front, whose nifty stick work puts the puck by Schmid at 10:35 of the first. Just 2 minutes of game time between goals now, and Schnarr wins the faceoff to the right of Schmid, straight to awaiting Kevin Waugh. Waugh pots one on his milestone game, 300th pro game, as the Rocket cut it to one. 3-2 Utica at 12:45 of period one. Towards the end of the first, we're not done with the first period yet. Hang on. Alex Belzile passes out in front through traffic. Sammy Niku puts the puck on net, but a save by Schmid bounces the puck right back to Belzile on the right-hand goal line, and he puts it in off the back of his leg pad We are all tied up. 3-3 at 18:26 of the first period. Very eventful first. No goals in the second, so we jump to the third. First, Raphael Harvey-Pernard finds Jean-Sebastien Day on a breakout chance, with Day forging ahead and putting a wrist shot by Schmid's glove side at 4:53 of the third. Laval has their first lead of the game, 4-3. The second goal of the frame was also Day, an empty net insurance goal at 19:13 to put the game out of reach. 5-3, Rocket come back and take Saturday's matchup against the Comets. Just a backbreaker of a weekend for Utica.
Yeah. Let's do some picks recap here real quick. CeCe, you took Utica Friday and Laval Saturday. I admitted that I did not want to do this, but I went with the Comets sweep here. I thought they would get revenge Wednesday. And Friday, you know, us covering a Laval game has not been good luck for Laval. So I thought that would be the Comets way. And that did not go well. The model getting it right as usual. Took both Canadian teams both days and picked up both points there. We talked about player management in the Comets missing big names, you know, in spots, Chase DeLeo, Alex Holtz, AJ Greer, Kevin Ball. Before diving into individual player performances, how did Utica adjust this weekend to those absent from the team and to those present after a missed game or so?
Well, DeLeo was there. He was present. But as we knew, both Greer and Fabian Zetterlin, a name that you didn't mention there, they were both called up to New Jersey on Wednesday. After recording our last episode on Friday, we found out that Kevin Ball was also heading up to the Devils as well. You mentioned load management, resting guys that needed it, as you know, Utica is, you know, looking towards the playoffs. This is the other side of the coin with players being called up to the parent club instead of sitting out and on the mend. New Jersey apparently wanting to get these guys some NHL reps because their playoff hopes are nil, non-existent. Yes, kaput. So the Comets, I tell you, they sorely missed these three, especially in that first game. There was no cohesion when it came to Utica trying to penetrate the Senators' zone. Every time the Comets tried to push ahead, Belleville made the neutral zone sludge. They pressed the Utica skaters and caused turnovers in really short order. I mean, Utica really couldn't get anything going offensively, and hence why they only scored one goal in that Friday game. Sean, you remember how one of our keys to the weekend was executing cleanly in the D zone, grabbing pucks off the wall for good decisions in that first breakout pass. Cleanliness is next to godliness.
Yep.
It didn't happen. No. The players didn't rebound from those previous mistakes that they made against Belleville on Wednesday that you were so, you know, wise to bring up that they would remedy that. And you even gave kudos to the Utica coaching staff for being able to adjust and tinker a little bit after a loss against the same team. It just bit them in the ass for four unanswered goals in the first period for the Beasons. They never recovered. I mean, they did not do Merrick Smittens any favors. You know, Akir Schmidt had to come in relief, and it just, it was a very hard first period to watch. And they mustered up a little bit more of an effort as the game went on. And they actually, it should have probably been a shutout because the Belleville player passing the puck, no look behind the goal line, and Irvine just there, you know, fourth line forward, just like, oh, hey, here we go. And Gustafson was just that close to actually getting it. He could have made that save, but yeah, it wasn't Utica's night, and Friday was just abysmal. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one of those where, you know, even if they managed to put up better efforts in the second and third, you know, come alive at least a little bit, it's kind of one of those, yeah, but you're down 4-0 already. That's, at least in the second period, that's garbage time adjacent. And in the third period, down 4-0, that is in fact garbage time. Right. So I wouldn't care as much because especially if you're Belleville, like you're up by four, you're not trying to win by seven. You're trying to just run the clock out and get the game down. So the fact that the Comets might've put up a little bit more fight in those later periods, I mean, it's nice. It's a morale booster, but at the same point, it's not that big a deal unless you can put pucks in the net and turn it into a live competitive game again. And yeah, Merrick Smitten's not doing, you know, getting done any favors, but also not doing any favors for the team. I understand he's been a little bit better more recently, but correct. At the end of the day, he's still very much a goaltender who is an ECHL guy at this stage of his career and probably doesn't have a ceiling too much higher than that. It's unfortunate, but you know, that's kind of the breaks about resting Schmid more, or trying to at least, is that you're going to have to tough out some Merrick Smittens moments like that. Or I guess in this case, not. I was surprised they swapped him. I would have thought, I'm like, well, if Mittens is in, it's going to be basically you are only coming out via injury or like it's 12-0 or something like that.
And I mean, you would have thought that maybe the coach would have, you know, pulled Mittens for the rest of the first period and then put him back in. I mean, I've seen coaches do that in the past, and it kind of wakes their team up a little bit. And it's like, okay, now, like, protect your goaltender. I don't care if it's Mittens. I don't care if it's Schmid. But yeah, it didn't happen. I mean, Schmid played the rest of the game, and then he played the rest of the game on Saturday night too. So
yeah, that's a little surprising. But
yeah,
I mean, I also would have liked to see like a Comets timeout after it was like 2-0 or something like that. You know, okay, guys, let's settle in. You know, Because once it becomes 3-0, that's when it's like the chances of you coming back from down 0-2 early in the first are one thing. But once it gets to about 3-0, that's when it's hope is starting to quickly dwindle.
I believe they did call a timeout. It was either after the second goal or the third goal. I can't remember. But yeah, I believe they did call a timeout and kind of gathered things up a little bit, and it didn't actually, yeah, you know what? I'm kind of blending the games together. I think it was actually the Vol called a timeout after the 3-0, and maybe that was the difference. Cause yeah, I just watched the Laval game prior to that. And so yeah, that's the one that's sticking out in my mind. So anyway.
No worries. But yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, as a coach, when you're in those moments, there's a limited number of things in which you can do to try and, turn the tide for your team. It's lines in a blender, switch goaltenders, call timeout. That's pretty much it. So, and I mean, there's yelling, but that's getting to be a less and less effective tool in the arsenal there. But it's, yeah, that would have been a moment I would like to have seen Kevin Dineen maybe call the timeout early. I'm a much bigger proponent of being aggressive with timeouts, whereas coaches feel like they have to save them for the last 2 minutes of the third and that's it. And I don't know. I also think giving coaches maybe like 2 timeouts or 3 over the course of the game or 1 per period may be a better use of them, but I don't know. So I'm guessing the Laval game had to have gone better than this though, right, CeCe?
I mean, initially it did. Yeah. I mean, you had, when your offense gets cranking like that early on, I mean, taking advantage of those cross ice passes, power play opportunity, you know, it sets your team up for success. I did notice that the Comets got bullied off the puck a lot by the Rocket after that. The Rocket just was not having being down 3-0 in their building, and the 7,500 fans in attendance at the Place Bell, forgive my Americanized accent, but you know, it was opposed to 2,200 at the CAA Center in Belleville the previous night. You know, that definitely helped fire up the Rocket. Like, that's the thing. The crowd didn't shut up. Like, oh yeah, they're like, oh, you know, of course, given the general reaction after each goal. But like after the 3-0, you know, they kept the juices going. And so, you know, that can pump a team up for sure. But
that place, I can tell you for a fact too, is loud. It's loud when there are 3,000 people in Place Bell. It's the fact that that's 7,500 people. Like, I don't know what the capacity is up that place off the top of my head. I think it's a little bit more than that, but like, I know that place is loud. It has been commented on by opposing teams and coaches that like, even when it's not a packed building, it's a loud building. It holds noise in really well. So 7,500 people, that is going to be a madhouse.
I'm glad you could back me up on that, cause it sounded hella loud on AHL TV. I'm like, holy cow. So yeah, I mean, Laval played fast and hard, big surprise there. After those 3 initial Utica goals, and the Comets got knocked on their butt all over again. You know, the defense just crumbled, and you know, they did well to trade chances in the second period, but Utica let Laval snatch victory from the jaws of defeat on the back of JS Day and Schmid's leaky glove side. I mean, yeah, that's his weak side. If you can get it past his glove, I mean, up high past his glove, that's his weak point right there. All 3 Utica goals didn't come on rebounds, which I know, as we've spoken quite a bit about here on the Calder Farmstead, is Caden Primeau's weakness. You know, he lets up rebounds quite frequently. Utica could have done better to exploit that, even with 3 goals on the board. Obviously, it wasn't enough for the dub. So, needed to tighten up the defense, need to get more goals on the board. The Comets also didn't defend the slot very well this game. Another key that we said needed to happen for them to prevent goals. They were lucky to have only 1 goal come from their shoddy slot protection. The rest came off, you know, as I mentioned before, Laval's bully tactic turnovers and that really speedy gameplay that they're just so good at.
I'm glad at least you got to see Laval look like a contender. I'm still waiting for my turn for that this season. So at least there's that we can, you know, have for us. But yeah, I like shoddy slot defense. That feels very appropriately worded. But we spoke about Brian Hallinen joining the Utica Comets before these 2 games. Did you see anything interesting from the Michigan Tech winger? Did he make an impact in his weekend debut here?
Well, actually, I made a mistake there. He's actually played 5 pro games. He joined at the beginning of April, so I wrote that in there and didn't set you up for success on that. So my apologies. No worries. But in his 4th and 5th pro games, not really. No, it's like we said before, he's a fourth line filler at this point. If not up in the press box, but I mean, with all the guys missing from Utica, you know, you plug him in on that right wing. I mean, he rolled with Irvine and Talvati on the fourth line in both games. Didn't have just a standout game. He just netted one shot on goal in each game, but nothing to really dock him for either. I know it's your favorite statistic, you know, no plus minus numbers, no penalty minutes. He's about as safe as a bet in the bottom six as you can get from an ATO college grad. And in my opinion, he's a better option than an ECHLer in that right wing spot on the fourth line. So he's being cautious and being conservative, which I think, you know, when you're just coming into this league, you want to make an impact, but you also don't want to, you know, make SportsCenter on the other side of the highlight reel or anything like that. I think, you know, Hallinen's doing well, and he's just kind of feeling out the pro game, and he's a serviceable fourth liner, serviceable bottom six guy.
All right. Besides Hallinen, let's talk about some individuals here. Who stood out this weekend for you on the Utica Comets?
I mean, the defense wasn't good. I don't need to name names to protect the innocent. I know we rarely do that on this show, but it's like just the defense overall was just so bad, and Laval torched him. Laval especially, just the Rocket lived up to their name and just, you know, rocket sauce all over the ice rink. It was just bad. That's a Jack Blackism right there. It's just rocket sauce. So anyway, don't mind me. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about the goaltenders. I mean, Schmidt coming in after Mittens shat the bed in that first game. That was a clutch effort, you know, 22 of 23 shots saved, but no goal support. I mean, it was really all for naught. And like you said, we're resting players coming towards the playoffs. Utica should be resting players. They should have just let Mittens be in there again, maybe pull him for the first period and, you know, let Schmidt finish it out and then bring Mittens back in. But no, they let him play, you know, 5/6 of the game, 80% of the game. And on Saturday, two of the goals that Schmidt had were on like snap reflex plays, a one-on-one chance in front, and then a one-timer off of a face-off in zone. So just bing, bang, boom. He just didn't have a whole lot of time to react. The third goal was off of a, you know, bad slot defense, shoddy slot protection, as I put earlier. And the fourth goal was off of a turnover in the neutral zone by Utica that led to a breakaway. JS Day just making him pay. You wouldn't think that the defense would fall apart without Kevin Ball this bad, but really without him to rally the troops on the ice, the Comets became cataclysmic in very short order.
The other big surprise too about leaving Schmidt in there is like the next day, you started to travel from Belleville to Laval, which not a far distance, but still, you know, packing up in the middle of the night to go there. 4 p.m. puck drop.
Mm-hmm.
Like that extra 3 hours definitely makes a little bit of a difference there. And to have your starter in that game, having played the night before and traveled, that is surprising that he didn't just, you know, come finish the period and then let Mittens go back in, or leave right. Mittens in there to just, hey, you're in there unless you are too injured to come out and play. But this is a decision Kevin's need with. I wouldn't call it wrong, but definitely not one that I would have made.
It's like we talked about last episode, Sean, with Schmid. You know, if given the option, do you think Schmidt's going to say no? Of course not.
Oh God, no. But like,
no. And maybe Dineen gave, you know, maybe Dineen gave the goalie's choice on that one. And yeah, I don't know.
I think that's a being adult in the room thing, being the adult in the room. Like you ask your, you know, 3-year-old if they want to have cookies for dinner every night, and they're always going to say yes, but that doesn't mean you should let them. Like,
correct.
Yeah. That's a metaphor. I don't think that's the actual maturity level of Akira Schmidt. In case anyone's
over-interpreting
that. Like, you have to be the one that's doing the best for your players, even when they want to play every game. Like, that's not good for them.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't agree with that. I wouldn't go as far as to say it was a bad decision by Kevin Dineen, but it is very in the ballpark of bad decision, I think, by him. But we'll see what they do from here. I really think when Nico Dawes comes back, like if I'm the Devils, I don't know, maybe call Merrick Mittens up to sit on the bench in New Jersey for a couple nights just to literally sit there. Like if they can have that down the stretch and send Dawes back to give Schmidt some rest. Cause they really miss Nico Dawes right now, because it's still, I think it looks like Schmidt is getting tired. and they need someone that they can at least put in the nets to be a little more serviceable. It looked like Merrick Mittens was, you know, starting to find the speed a little bit in the last couple games, but evidently not. So I don't know. All right. That was the rear view mirror looking back. Let's look forward here for the Utica Comets. Where does Utica go from here, CeCe?
Well, Utica plays their old friend Syracuse at home on Friday. The Crunch are 3-10 against the Comets this season. Syracuse is 7-3 in their last 10, though. So this is what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object. Easy enough for me to say. Blech. Anyway. Saturday, the Comets host the Belleville Senators. They get a chance to go against the BSens again. The BSens are 2-3 against Utica this season, but they have taken the last two games, that Wednesday and Friday set that we talked about earlier. Belleville is 5-5 in their last 10 games.
And importantly, too, I think both of those are in Utica. So big chance for Ball's Army and the rest of the Comets and their 9 Facebook fan pages to fill the Adirondack Bank Center.
Salute to you guys.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break here. After the break, we will get to the Central Division and the green showdown between Iowa and Texas. If you're just here for Utica, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. Links to our social media and more can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Okay, the Eastern Conference is all wrapped up, at least for our feature series that we're covering. Time to go over to the West, time to go over to the Central Division. And as Sean put it before the break, the Green Series. The Green Series, Iowa Wild versus the Texas Stars, Saturday at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 5 p.m., both in Cedar Park, Texas. Sean, we had some goals. I think you should probably tell the people how it went.
Saturday, Ben Gleason makes a nice pass into the neutral zone to Joe Lesperance that dissolves the Wild forecheck. Lesperance gains the zone and finds Frederick Karlstrom across Royal Road. Karlstrom rips a shot that beats Zane McIntyre's glove. 1-0 Stars with 12:56 left in the first period. Then Joe Hicketts gets a puck at the point, executes a nice little give and go with Mason Shaw. Hicketts gets the return pass across Royal Road in the slot after shaking Joel Lesperance. And backhands one that Adam Scheel just can't get enough of. Tie game at 1, just under 3 minutes into the second period. Another give and go goal from the point. This time, Curtis McKenzie works the puck down the wall from the front. Works the puck down the wall from the point to Tanner Caro. Caro makes a no-look backhanded pass that deflects to a streaking McKenzie in the slot. McKenzie snipes one low blocker to retake the Texas lead 2-1 with 3:56 left in the second. The puck comes to John Lizotte at the point, and he spins off an Anthony Lewis hit. Lizotte tries to pass across to Brennan Miller, but it's deflected by Curtis McKenzie. The puck bounces outside the zone, but Miller scoops it back in quickly, avoids an offside call, and throws a shot on the net. Kyle Rau gets a tip on it, and it goes in. The goal somehow stands. Tie game at 2, just 44 seconds into the third period. Just as the penalty to Mason Shaw expires, Ryan Shea gains the Iowa zone, sees Riley Damiani flying past Joe Hicketts, finds him with a pass. Damiani gets stopped on his shot, but gets the rebound to Rhett Gardner, who jams it home with the side of the net. 3-2 Stars with 7:14 left in the third. But Dakota Mermis dangles past Alex Petrovic to gain the Texas blue line. Petrovic smacks the puck off Mermis's stick, but Nolan Stevens corrals it in the high slot. Stevens shoots and Scheel makes the save, but he can't control the rebound. Cody McLeod is there to bang it in. Tie game at 3 with 6:13 left in the third period.
Sorry.
Regulation and OT do not give us a winner, and we head to the world of competitive coin flipping for a decision, the shootout. Connor Dewar and Tanner Caro both score on straight snipes on their team's opening attempts, but it would take 5 more rounds of the shootout before Nick Sweeney would win it for Iowa with a beautiful fake shot to the forehand finish. Iowa wins it in the shootout 4-3. Sunday. The Texas penalty kill over pursues along the wall and leaves Dakota Mermis with a wide open shooting lane at the point. Mermis fires a one-timer off a pass from Beckman that Nick Sweeney gets a tip on. Adam Scheel makes the initial save, but Rosberg can't box out Mason Shaw, and Shaw puts the rebound in. 1-0 Wild with 8:06 left in the first. During 4-on-4 play, quick puck movement by the Wild has Kalen Addison quickly find Mitchell Chafee on the half wall. Chafee cuts back and skates along the blue line, beats Ty Dellandrea, cuts the home plate area, and fires a wrister that goes over the blocker of Shield. 2-0 Wild, 11:15 in the second. Dominic Turgeon hits the empty net that seals it for Iowa, and 3-0 is your final score. Iowa takes both games.
Well, I got some owning up to do because I took a Texas sweep in the picks. So, yeah, Sean, you had a caveat, little different here. You said you were going to take the split. You say McIntyre wins his start for the Wild. If he starts both games, Texas wins on Sunday. So I guess one of two ain't too bad. You got one. There you
got
go.
One.
The model making fools of the both of us once again. 51.2% Iowa, the favorite both nights on the road. The machines win again. But anyway, let's talk about the game itself, team level takeaways. Sean, this surely felt like a mini playoff series this weekend as both teams are basically fighting for that last playoff spot in the Central. And not, yeah, they both haven't officially clinched yet. Milwaukee and Rockford, I'm talking about, haven't officially clinched yet. They're not going anywhere. Iowa won both of these games, but Sean, were they the best team wearing green this weekend in the AHL?
I'd say no, that's probably Abbotsford, but I don't think that's what you were getting at. Iowa won both these games, but I genuinely thought Texas was the better team in four, maybe five out of the six regular regulation periods that they played.
Wow. Okay. So then how did Iowa come away with the W's this weekend?
Quite simply, Zane McIntyre willed them to these wins. He was outright fantastic. And while others played well for the Wild over the course of both games, Zane McIntyre repeatedly bailed out defensive breakdowns, stopped a lot of scoring chances that he had no business even facing. The Wild PK went 12 for 12 this weekend, which was one of our keys. But that was not because of the guys in front of him. I actually thought the penalty kill in front of Zane McIntyre was kind of bad at times, but McIntyre was the savior of bacon for Iowa all weekend without question. And that's not to say that Iowa played poorly the entire weekend, but as we talked in the preview, two key areas, one of them was Iowa containing Texas's speed and their ability to get north-south. And while they had some stretches of success in doing that, I want to say the second period on Saturday's game was their best effort in kind of keeping a lid on Texas. Texas, by and large, got to play fast. That fast north-south counterattack rush chance kind of game that they wanted to. The other big key was Iowa was the penalty kill. We already talked about that. They killed all 12 penalties that they faced, or power plays that they gave up, rather. But that was, I would say, by and large, the effort of Zane McIntyre. You say your goalie needs to be your best penalty killer, and he was their first, second, and third best penalty killer. Not to mention the goal to tie the game at 2 in the first minute of the third period was that was on Saturday. That was offside and shouldn't have counted. But that's not reviewable, which is insane. So once it was called a goal, according to AHL rule, I want to say it's 79.3 off the top of my head. You are not able to review a goal for offside. It's not allowed by AHL rules. I think that's incredibly dumb. Because
it is by NHL rules, if I recall correctly.
It is by NHL rules. Why that is not part of the AHL rule book, especially when like this isn't like a not every building has the technology to do that thing. They all do. They all have a little iPad that you can, you know, dial up AHL TV and hit rewind. Like, it's nothing special about it anymore. So the fact that they're not able to use that tool is big dumb to me. But Tim Army also sent out the line of Baddock, Turgeon, and McLeod over the boards way too much. Especially too, sending that line out there with Turner Ottenbright on defense to me is just silly. That's three of your slowest and probably worst players on defense on the ice at the same time. I mean, I feel bad for Dominic Turgeon having to center that line because he's just getting weighed down by them. Especially the idea that you're benching, you know, Giroux or first off for them is just crazy to me. I don't understand what Tim Army thinks that line is bringing. And a few times too, Neil Graham caught them out there and sent the Lewis Dellandrea McKenzie line out there and they gave him the business. And a couple times too, you saw Texas try and line match that fourth line of Iowa and Tim Army pulled them off the ice as fast as he could. It's almost as like he knew that was real bad for him, which just begs the question, why did you put them in the lineup in the first place? But if I'm Texas, though, yeah, that first period start on Sunday was bad. There are a few small areas that I felt like need cleaning up. A few opportunities on the rush that I had me scratching my head. I feel like they kind of wasted a good rush chance and decided to just kind of dump and chase when that wasn't necessary. But overall, they very much got to play their game outside of that first Saturday period where the Wild were the better team in Sunday's first period, rather. No question about it. But by and large, the other five of the six periods, I'd say, you know, Texas, they got to play fast. They used their speed well. They rolled four lines that could generate chances, and they did. The power play looked incredibly dangerous by and large. They had a couple power plays that maybe didn't go their way, but over the course of 12 of them, I'd say they had good quality scoring chances on at least eight. They controlled the pace for the majority of play. They controlled possession for the majority of play. They just couldn't get puck luck on a few good scoring chances. On Sunday, Joel Esperance hit two crossbars. If both those go bar down instead of bar out, entirely different game. If Ty Dellandrea doesn't get absolutely robbed on a high danger shot as the first period is ending on Sunday, entirely different game. If that goal gets called offside as it was supposed to on Saturday, that probably changes, you know, how the outcome of that game works out. A lot of just little tiny things that you could point to and be like, yeah, that's one singular moment, hitting a crossbar and not having it go bar down instead of bar out. It's bad luck. Like, I think Texas was the better team here, but Zane McIntyre did the voodoo and Texas just could not get puck luck in some of those moments that would have changed the outcome, I think.
Let's dive into some of the individuals here. Sean, who stood out to you positively and negatively for this Central Division Hulk Smash Green Machine Showdown?
I mean, I'll start with Dakota Mermis. I think over the course of the weekend, Mermis dangled five stars right out of their jocks. He really found good spots to come off the blue line in the cycle, was excellent at beating guys one-on-one on offense in those moments. I'm still not a big fan of his defensive game, but I'll be honest, watching him dance around dudes and making them look foolish this weekend was definitely a lot of fun. Anytime you have the puck on your stick and a clear, unobstructed pass to the net, you should do the obvious thing, turn on the jets, head to the net. And yet, Mason Shaw had at least two instances where he had an unobstructed path directly to the net on the rush and thought, yeah, but maybe I don't go as fast and instead try and make a pass to someone else. And both times I literally hit pause and was just like, what are you doing, baby? It was like Shaw played a pretty decent game outside of those moments, but they were just two moments, one Saturday and one Sunday where he made a pass backwards when he had a clear path to the net on like a partial-ish breakaway where he could have gone, you know, shoulder down and dragged the puck and, you know, had a good scoring chance. Like, yeah, but backward. It was bizarre. We mentioned it before, but Turner Ottenbright was brutal this weekend. If Iowa makes the playoffs in the Central, he is going to be one of the reasons they get eliminated. Mark my words. He's big and strong and physical, but he rarely seems to put those attributes to good use in an effective way. He's not good at moving the puck. He struggles with cleanly retrieving dump-ins. He's not a good skater and is susceptible to being burned by guys who can turn the corner on him. He's not an outright liability, but he's very exploitable and teams are going to look to exploit him in the playoffs. Like all of those moments in which the Stars got, you know, the Dellandrea Lewis McKenzie line out there against Ottenbright, they made him pay. They generated scoring chances. The fact that Zane McIntyre bailed him out on those is probably the difference between a lot of people's opinion of did Ottenbright play good defense or not. But I can tell you he did not. A mostly good weekend for Alex Petrovic. He's definitely starting to find his groove here and getting to, you know, get going in a few spots, but definitely a few moments where he made decisions that were not advisable. Chasing an open ice hit in the neutral zone on Sunday nearly sprang a Wild 3-on-1 rush the other way. Still, made a lot more solid plays, moving the puck, defending well for the most part. I liked what I saw from Alex Petrovic, starting to see the guy that we saw in previous seasons in Providence and in Stockton find his game in Texas. So that's good for the Stars. The usuals for Texas were also solid. Damiani, Lewis, Delandria, Curtis McKenzie to a lesser extent. Definitely some questionable moments. Had a penalty on Sunday, which surprisingly was only the third stupidest penalty take on this weekend. The Wild with six guys on the ice for like an extended period of time and a Cody McLeod cross-checking penalty were second and first place in the stupidest. But the one McKenzie took on Sunday where he basically just two-hand cross-checks a dude 4 seconds after he passes the puck for no reason. Bronze medal for stupidest penalty. So that kind of detracts from my thoughts on him on the weekend. But that was pretty much it. Obviously, Zane McIntyre stood out, but I kind of felt like that one went without saying. But here we are. I'll say it. Zane McIntyre was great.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, give credit where credit's due. All right. That was the weekend that was for Iowa and Texas. Hold on to your butts. This is the playoff race in the Western Conference because San Jose has officially been eliminated this weekend as they played Henderson. We'll get to that later. And Tucson is out too. So this is the playoff race in the Western Conference. So Sean, what does Iowa have to look forward to down the stretch? And what does Texas have to look forward to down the stretch?
Yeah, both have rough schedules. Iowa has a traditional Monday, Friday, Saturday, 3-4, and it's a Grand Rapids sandwich. Wednesday and Saturday are against Milwaukee. Milwaukee is 6-2 against Iowa this season, but Iowa has won two of the last three against Milwaukee. The Admirals hitting some rough patches here, 5-5 in their last 10 games. They miss Rocco Grimaldi a lot. Friday is the Grand Rapids part of the sandwich there, because you named the sandwich after the thing in the middle. It's not a rye sandwich, it's a ham sandwich. So
fair.
Griffins are 4-2 against the Wild this weekend, with each side shutting each other out in their last weekend series in early March. Griffins are on the struggle bus. They are 3-7 in their last 10 games, but they did manage a Wild comeback against the Marlies earlier in the week. So they're not totally dead in the water. Texas also hosts its own traditional Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, 3-4. But all of them are against the Chicago Wolves, which, yeah, that's a rough one. Chicago is 7-2 against Texas this season. Chicago is 8-2 in their last 10, but one of those losses is to Texas. So, but yeah, that is not the team you want to be. They at least get to stay in Texas for that series. But yeah, that's a rough one against Chicago.
Right. And you've got those two games later on this month, Iowa and Texas in Iowa, I believe. So
yeah,
that's going to be crucial.
Those are probably going to decide this playoff spot. And that I'm going to say it right now. We're going to cover that series.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, why wouldn't we? Again, this is the playoff race, the only playoff race in the Western Conference. So everything else is positioning and seeding at this point. But this is to determine whether Iowa or Texas gets that fifth and final spot in the Central Division.
All right. Well, that is it for our coverage of the Green Series showdown in the Central Division. After the break, we will get to Henderson and San Jose. If you're just here for Iowa and Texas, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. We have some fun there. Links to all of that stuff and more can be found in our Linktree page at linktr.ee/thecalderfarmstead. A thing I can hope you can that you don't need spelled out for you. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
All right, we are on our last featured series of the weekend, and of course we're going to go out west and head to the Pacific Division, Henderson and San Jose for their weekend series, Saturday at 6 p.m. Pacific, Sunday at 1:15 p.m. Pacific. Quick little turnaround there. Sean, there was a few goals, more than a few, a grip of goals, if you will.
Yeah, let's get to it here. Saturday, Jasper Weatherby breaks up a Silver Knights pass in the Barracuda zone, but he and Evan Weinger can't control the puck. Jermaine Lowen swoops in, takes possession, turns, and fires a wrist shot that Ben Jones tips past Stalock. 1-0 Silver Knights with 12:21 remaining in the first period. Less than a minute later, Leighton Ahak banks a pass off the boards to Daniil Merimanov, who chips it to Paul Cotter as the Silver Knights fly through the neutral zone. Cotter easily walks past Hallway and fires a shot 5-hole that beats Stalock. 2-0 Silver Knights. On the power play, Joachim Blichfeld passes east to west across Royal Road to Jasper Weatherby. Weatherby taps it up to the point for Artemi Nazyev, and he one-times it past Yuri Patera to bring the Cuda back within one, 18:53 left in the first. Jack Dugan gains the Cuda zone on a rush chance. He pulls up after getting angled to the wall and finds Caden Korzak at the point. Korzak one-times the pass that Weinger blocks, but the rebound takes a Silver Knights bounce to Ben Thompson, and Thompson swats it past Stalock, 3-1 Silver Knights with 5:04 left in the first. Jermaine Lowen intercepts a pass in the Silver Knights' end and gets a counterattack going for Henderson. Ben Jones gains the Barracuda zone and slips a pass under the stick of Joachim Blichfeld to Lowen. Lowen one-times it past Alex Stalock's glove, 4-1 Silver Knights with 1:54 left in the first period. Ben Thompson strips Nazyev at the Knights in the Knights zone, but can't get a clear. Zachary Glant recovers the point and gives it back to Nazyev, who skates across the point and turns and fires a blind prayer at the net. His prayers are answered as Dylan Hameluk gets a tip on it past Patera, 4-2 with 16:26 left in the second. Ben Jones gains the Barracuda zone, gains the Barracuda blue line on the power play, skates down the wall, pulls up, and passes to Colt Conrad at the point. Conrad makes a beautiful pass east-west across Royal Road, right in the wheelhouse for Jack Dugan, who one-times it past Stalock, 5-2 Silver Knights, 6:44 left in the third period. The Cuda break up a zone exit as Kyle Topping recovers a puck at the point and in the Silver Knights zone. He skates to the slot and dishes the puck to Santeri Hataka at the point. Hataka one-times it from distance. Patera can't make the high blocker save, and the Cuda get a garbage time goal, 5-3 with 47 seconds left in regulation. Braden Paschal hits the empty net from 200 feet away to close the game out. 6-3, Silver Knights is your final. Sunday. Colt Conrad intercepts a pass in the Silver Knights zone, turns up the ice, and finds Maxim Mereshev in the neutral zone for a quick outlet. Mereshev goes cross ice in the neutral zone for Pavel Dorofeyev. Dorofeyev goes gives it to a streaking Colt Conrad, who's outraced four Cuda defenders, walks in on a breakaway. Conrad backhands one over Amond. 1-0, Silver Knights, just 2:19 into the game. Joachim Blichfeld pulls the puck out of a board battle and passes up the wall to Anthony Beteto. Beteto works a give and go with Blichfeld on the half wall. Beteto gets the return pass, skates into the slot, and wrists one past the glove of Isaiah Saville. Saville, tie game at 1, 11:56 in the first period. Zachary Amond fields a dump in and gives it a hard rimmer back up the wall against the blue line where Daniil Mirimanov one-times it back on the net. Amond makes the save, but Ben Jones beats Montana Onyebuchi to the rebound, 2-1 Henderson with 11:16 left in the first period. On the power play, Alan Quine makes a pass to Daniil Mirimanov while falling down to keep the puck onside. Mirimanov finds Jack Dugan on the half wall, and Dugan collapses the Barracuda penalty kill. But Dugan still manages to find Quine across Royal Road on a wide-open passing lane. Quine wrists it home past Amon, who had no chance, 3-1 with 9:46 left in the first period. Colt Conrad strips Nick Cicek in the Henderson zone and springs the Silver Knights on an odd man rush the other way. Conrad draws Beteto to him and passes to Makoshin, who one-touches it to Pavel Dorofeyev. Dorofeyev kicks it skate to stick and backhands one past a sprawling Amon, 4-1 Knights, 3:28 left in the first. Lane Peterson gets a pass from Adam Raska and enters the Silver Knights zone shorthanded. Peterson goes wide where he takes a low danger shot, but Saville cannot makes the save, but cannot control the rebound. It goes right into the slot. Neither Daniil Mirimanov nor Jack Dugan hustles to pick up Santeri Hataka, and he taps it into a wide open net, 4-2 Knights with 17:48 left in the second. Ian Makoshin fires a shot from the point that Amon stops. Amon overextends, making the save, and Pavel Dorofeyev is easily able to grab the rebound and stuff a wraparound into a wide-open net, 5-2 Henderson, with 11:38 left in the second. Off a turnover, Jaden Halbuka walks, flies through the neutral zone, and passes to Lane Peterson as he gains the zone. Peterson flings a pass across Royal Road and finds Joachim Blichfeld for a one-timer that Saville had no chance at. 5-3 Knights with 4:09 left in the second. Under light forechecking pressure, Anthony Beteto fumbles a puck from behind the net that goes right to Reed Duke in the slot. Duke shoots it past Amond for the Christmas present goal. Beteto is not credited with an assist, however. 6-3 Silver Knights with 17:59 left in the third. Less than a minute later, Nazyev loses control of the puck in the Henderson zone, and the Silver Knights take off the other way. Ben Jones goes 2-on-2 with Alan Quine, but Quine outmaneuvers Nazeev into the slot, and Jones finds him with a pass through Brinson Pasenchuk. Quine redirects it past Amon to make it 7-3 Silver Knights. That would mercifully end it. 7-3 Silver Knights is your final. They sweep the weekend.
You know, I jokingly said you might need some water before that 1-0 Syracuse Wilkes-Barre Scranton game that you covered, but 19 total goals on the weekend that you just ran through. Nicely done, sir. Nicely done. Let's talk picks. Our good friend Kevin Lacey from Teal Town USA came on the show last episode. He picked Henderson on Saturday and San Jose with an overtime win on Sunday. I said Henderson needed a get-right game. They take Saturday and San Jose would take Sunday. Sean, you went all Han Solo on us, and I have a bad feeling about this. And you said Henderson sweep, but guess what? You were the only one who got it right because the model said San Jose was the favorite. 51.8%. Sean goes, yeah, party down, party time. So Sean picking correctly, the Henderson sweep. And you said this was a good chance for the struggling Silver Knights to reset, get right against a team that they could clearly handle. As the old sports adage goes, you got to win the games that you're supposed to win. And Henderson sure did. So is that what you saw?
When you're clunkers.
When you're clunkers. There you go. That's another
one. When you're clunkers. That is definitely what I saw. Both games were 4-1 at the end of the first period. The penalty kill went 7-for-8 against one of the best power plays in the league. Power play went 2-for-7. Alan Quine broke a 4-game pointless streak. Dorofeev broke a 6-game goalless streak. Jack Dugan looked sharp after basically a month off. Both goaltenders played reasonably well. The team forechecked pretty well. Overall, they look just like the Silver Knights team we're more accustomed to seeing and not the one that's been struggling the last month plus. Now, is that going to project forward? I absolutely don't know, and no one can. But I'd like to think that it would, but that doesn't make it so. Still, if this team needed a confidence boost, it has to have gotten one from this weekend.
Sean, were there any areas of concern to take away? I mean, obviously a pair of, you know, 3+ goal wins. It's probably hard to find negative areas, but did you see anything that at least should be brought up here in review for the Silver Knights?
Always. I have yet to see a team play a mistake-free, perfect game. These were no different. As you said, nothing major, but still some topics that should be brought up in meetings this week. While the penalty kill produced results going 7-for-8 against the top power play, I thought the process looked sloppy at times. Isaiah Saville had to make some big cross-crease saves as well as saves on shots that shouldn't have happened in the first place. I'd like to see the PK defending those east-west passes getting through Royal Road a little bit better. Those need to get cleaned up. I'd like them to see them defend the blue line on the penalty kill a little better. Forechecking effort while shorthanded really didn't do too much to keep the Cuda from gaining the zone pretty easily. Also, there were a lot of A-plus back-checking efforts by the Silver Knights this weekend, but there are also a lot of suspect ones. Joachim Blickfeld doesn't score that goal if forwards were scanning over their shoulder and saw him there. Same with Hataka's goal. There were a few other similar scoring chances that were given up that were similar. I'd like to see those get cleaned up, but overall a good back-checking hustle effort by the Silver Knights, just two or three that led to goals or quality scoring chances where it was just a simple case of they, you know, didn't look over their shoulder. They got caught puck watching when it was, you know, a 1-on-3 rush, and then somebody comes streaking in. They're just not paying attention. Those moments are not good ones where you're giving up goals when you are in a reverse odd man rush situation there. But that's really it, though. I was genuinely happy with the Silver Knights play. A couple of mistakes and some things that needed to be cleaned up, but overall, two big dubs for them.
Here, Kevin and I thought it was just going to be a get right game, but they ended up having a get right weekend. So good for them. Good for them. On the San Jose side of things, any thoughts on them?
Yeah, but it's nothing we haven't said before. This is a team for the life of it cannot execute a breakout consistently or execute cleanly in transition, especially under any semblance of forechecking pressure, but they also fail under no pressure at all. So at least they're consistent. They're a comedy of errors on the penalty kill. They defend the net front in the high slot in a painfully bad way. And because of it, their goaltenders are basically under assault all night. But none of that went away this weekend. And yes, I realize they've lost a lot of talent to call-ups. Reedy, Leonard, Chmielewski, Gregor, Veal, if you want to call that talent. Merkley, Megna, others. Those are just the ones kind of off the top of my head. that's still a lot. And yes, other teams have had to deal with similar issues. Hershey's in the middle of it. Manitoba's gone through it earlier this year. Hartford's done it at least twice. Bridgeport for stretches of the year. And as we said, when you lose that many important players, you lose games. Top six forwards aren't grown in a lab underneath the SAP Center. But when those teams have faced those roster struggles, the Hershey's, the Bridgeports, the Manitobas, they've at least gone down swinging. They've looked competent in defeat for the most part. Hershey's, by and large, losing one-goal games or one-goal games with an empty netter. Same is true of Hartford. San Jose has lost 26 games this season by three or more goals. That's over 60% of their losses this season. They are tied with Tucson at 26. No other team in the league even has 20.
Oh, my God. Wow.
You can see that figure. Watch how poorly this team plays on a regular basis. How poorly prepared they look. And you can't convince me that the Barracuda coaching staff should come back for next season. To me, in the lyrics of the immortal Sam Smith, the writing's on the wall.
Ooh, yeah. You know, if only those orange jerseys would stay around another season or two. I mean, they're playing so bad, their orange jerseys got relegated. Like, that's how bad that they're playing. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I went there. Their jerseys, their sweet-ass orange jerseys got relegated. But anyway, let's dive into the player side here. Sean, what individual stuck out to you this series? I'm guessing it's going to be Henderson heavy and probably not too many Barracuda players. But
I have at least one positive for San Jose. So we got one. But I always do my best here to call out players who, in my observation, deserve it, both positively and negatively. And I try to do that without regard how I feel about how their game is in general. Good players have bad weekends and deserve, you know, to be held accountable for that. Bad players have good weekends and deserve the credit that comes with that. So it shocked me, but I have to give credit where it's due here. Jermaine Loewen was good this weekend. Made a lot of small plays that don't show up on the score sheet, but help, you know, your team keep the flow of play in your direction. He was effective on the forecheck. His goal wasn't fluky. That was a legit snipe. He didn't take bad penalties. He didn't chase hits. He was an effective power forward this weekend and not just the physical grinder that he usually is. And his effort and results from this weekend are worthy of praise. Good on him. Colt Conrad was another that was just hustling. Had great timing this weekend. It seemed like he was in the right place at the right time repeatedly. And I don't think that's just good luck either. That was awareness and hockey IQ combined with work ethic. Going into the weekend, I don't even think I knew his number off the top of my head. That's not to say I haven't seen him play before, but it wasn't glued in my brain. But by the second period of Sunday's game, I didn't have to look anymore. I knew when I saw 79 doing something good, I didn't have to look up 79. I knew that was Cole Conrad because having to do it so many times, I'm like, man, who made that? Who's 70? Yeah, by midway through Sunday's game, I knew who 79 was. My one positive for San Jose, I thought Lane Peterson played pretty well. He was a force for good out there for San Jose on the majority of his shifts. Doesn't have any negative comments in my game notes for the series, which, given that, you know, how bad the series went for San Jose, I'd say that in itself is a positive thing to remark. I do want to highlight one negative for San Jose in particular, though. Nick Cicek can skate well, or Cicek can skate well. He has some good instincts in the offensive zone. He activates off puck into the rush a lot and is effective in doing so. But he is truly terrible on breakouts, fielding pucks off the wall and dump-ins. He's not good in board battles. He's listed at 6'3", 200 pounds, and he lost a board battle to 5'10", 185-pound Colt Conrad. He lost battles in the corners and the net front repeatedly. He got absolutely bodied by Alan Quine off a puck on the wall. He's found new and innovative ways to turn the puck over on breakouts, including one around the 13-minute mark of the second period of Sunday's game. If you want to go look it up, I genuinely had to hit pause and just like yell into the abyss, what are you doing? He skated himself into a corner and then like made a blind rim around and got instantly picked off by Henderson. Under the most minimal forechecking pressure imaginable. It was bizarre. And that hasn't been a new development in my viewings of Cicek either. This wasn't just like a good player having a bad weekend or just an off, you know, two games. Like, this is what I've seen from him every single time. But today San Jose announced a 2-year NHL contract for him. And I just, I don't get it. I have no idea what they see in doing that. He has some offensive upside. Like, he's not without any skill, but like, he's absolutely a net negative for that Barracuda team. And I don't think it's going to get much better.
Well, with that said, let's look forward. I know San Jose, again, technically eliminated from the, I mean, they were eliminated a long time ago from our model. Yeah. And like,
let's be completely clear. When they traded Mark Alt, that was the white flag of the season. That was we need bodies on defense who are capable, and we're literally giving one of them up. That was the, we're just taking knees here, running out the season in garbage time. That was the sign. But from here, San Jose is a shorter weekend than normal. Week than normal. They host Bakersfield Wednesday at 7 p.m. The Condors are 5-3 against the Cuda this season. Bakersfield has cooled off a little bit. They're just 6-4 in their last 10. Reality has come for them a little bit more. The Barracuda then host Abbotsford Friday at 5 p.m. The Canucks are 4-3 against San Jose this season. Abbotsford is 7-3 in their last 10 and have won 4 straight. But that is it for San Jose. A Wednesday and a Friday. They're off Saturday, Sunday, which is a little bizarre, but
that's happened a few times with them this season.
That's been one of the reasons we haven't got to cover them this much, just because that's been their schedule, and it feels weird to like the Pacific is so full of teams to give just a one game weekend to a Pacific Division team. So that's,
are they the only Pacific Division team that plays that shares a building with their NHL parent club?
Yes.
That might do it. Sorry, I mean, just had a little epiphany there. Possibly. Yeah,
scheduling probably conflict. A good portion of it. Anyway, Henderson hosts Stockton for your good old fashioned Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, 3-4. They have Stockton for all three games. The Heat are 2-3 against the Silver Knights this season. I genuinely had to double check that because I didn't believe it was true. But the Silver Knights have a winning record against Stockton this season. I think they may be one of the only teams. Stockton is forever on a heater, it seems. They are 7-3 in their last 10, 1-3 of their last 4. So maybe this is where they even it up, but Henderson has seemed to have their number a little bit this year.
That would make an interesting playoff series if Henderson were to get beyond the opening round, which we'll see. We'll see.
Well, if they get beyond the opening rounds, they're, I think, a lock to play Stockton. Are they not?
Really?
Well, I think they're in lowest seed.
They're in sixth place currently.
So they jumped San Diego, but
they did. Yeah.
Okay. But,
That would be a hell of a second round matchup. So
I mean, God, if they got Logan Thompson too, could you imagine? Ooh. Could you imagine?
Ooh.
Wow. If Henderson upset Stockton in the second round, that would be, oh,
be still my fantasy booking heart. Oh my God. Gosh.
That would be, I mean, I don't think it's gonna happen. Stockton's
just, no, I don't either. No,
yeah. Anyway, we're gonna take a break here. After the break, we will get to our favorite segment for CC and his voice impersonations, the cream of the crop, the best players of the weekend in the AHL. And we do have a quiz this weekend, so let's have some fun with that. If you were just here for Henderson in San Jose, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever listening to us from, so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, make sure you check us out on social media. Links to our social media pages, all the places you can listen to our podcast or watch us that people regularly use, and some other stuff can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/the Calder Farmstead. We're going to run some ads, pay some bills. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Okay, yeah, it's time for the madness, and let me tell you a little something. Oh, yeah, I got some Macho Madness on my shirt. Yeah, the cream always rises to the top. Oh, can you dig it? Yeah, unjustifiably in a position I'd rather not be in, but the cream rises to the top. It's on the shirt. Can you dig it? It's the image of the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Yeah! All right, well, that all aside, I think it's time to talk about the best AHL players of the weekend and the cream of the crop. And I think my cohort, Sean O'Brien, the toughest SOB out there, he needs to gain his composure a little bit, because maybe I am a little insane. And maybe you need to challenge me for the Intercontinental Championship at WrestleMania 3. Yeah!
All right. My third cream of the crop this weekend is Riley Barber. 4 goals, no assists for 4 points on the weekend. Obviously, all primary points. Led the comeback effort as he had a power play hat trick to somehow get the Griffins to overcome a 4-1 deficit over Toronto to win 7-5. Also, fun fact, none of those power play goals were scored in the barbershop either, which is genuinely surprising. CeCe, who is your third cream of the crop for the weekend?
Well, my third cream of the crop is going to be Edwards Trailmox for the Providence Bruins. 4 points, a goal and assist each game in the home-and-home split against Bridgeport. We're talking about the Islanders. If you got anything to say about it, I'm going to give you the elbow drop from the top rope and then hit you with a pile driver. Yeah! But anyway, Trailmox, he got those 4 points, and he's making his mocks. Yeah, making his mocks around the AHL. That was a loose pun, but I'm afraid you're going to have to give that to me, because Edwards Trailmox, Providence Bruins, my third cream of the crop. Yeah!
My second cream of the crop is Ben Jones from the Henderson Silver Knights. 2 goals, 3 assists for 5 points, 4 primary points. Helped his team get off to good starts in both games against San Jose. Primary assist on the eventual game winner on Saturday. Just ripping it up both games, everywhere on the ice. Ben Jones, Henderson Silver Knights, second cream of the crop for the weekend. Macho CeCe, who you got?
Oh, you know, I think I'm going to go in net with this one. I'm going to talk about Zane the Brain McIntyre. Yeah, net intelligence, if you will. Oh, you see what I did there? AHL's player of the week, not just goaltender, but the player of the week. But hey, we're just focusing on the weekend here. 68 saves on 71 shots, including a 3-0 shutout on Sunday against the Texas Stars. Those are pivotal, pivotal 4 points in the Central Division as the Wild and the Stars fight for that fifth and final playoff spot in the Central. Zane the Brain McIntyre. Zane O'Mac, yeah, coming off the cage with a shutout. 68 saves, 71 shots on goal. Man, I tell you, that's something. My second cream of the crop.
For me, number one cream of the crop, the top of the cream of the crop, is Max Lagasse, Syracuse Crunch. Stopped a 68 of 71 shots on the weekend for a 960 save percentage. Backstopped his team to 2 wins, including a 48 save shutout against the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins. Absolutely lights out in that game against the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins. Stole a game for the Syracuse Crunch. That's my guy. Top of the cream of the crop, Max Lagasse, Syracuse Crunch.
Well, you're talking about legacy, Lagasse, if you will. I've got a bit of a legacy or a Lagasse, depending on your pronunciation. But Jean-Sebastien Day is my top of the cream of the crop, Laval Rocket. He set up the game-tying and game-winning overtime goals for the 3-4 victory with the Rocket. Yeah! On Friday against Rochester, and then he helped the Rocket with 2 third-period goals in a 5-3 win against the Utica Comets on Saturday. Jean-Sebastien Day, he's going off, yeah! Let me tell you, Macho Man, he's not going to be surprised if this guy gets a cup of coffee in the big time. JS Day, my top of the cream of the crop. Nobody does it better from the weekend that was. Oh, yeah. Slim Jim.
I have to ask you, how long have you been waiting to do the like?
So this was actually a delayed birthday gift from a friend of mine, and I just received it in the mail today. And it's a play off of the Wu-Tang Clan, Cream. So yeah, Cream. There you go. Cream of the crop rises to the top. Wu-Tang Clan has that song Cream. So it's a little play on that with the Macho Man logo, the upside down Wu-Tang Clan logo. So
that is as soon as I saw that,
lost it. I loved it.
That was hilarious.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
All right. It is time for a quiz.
Yes, let's do it.
All right. This is a version of a quiz we've done before called The Franchise. We had a couple of milestone movers in recently. Hershey winning their 3,000th game. Cody Clark making me scramble for the Mr. 3000 meme. But we got it done. So we're going to talk about the franchise. So these are the franchise leaders in a category. I'm going to give you three names. You're going to have to tell me who is the franchise leader in that category. And here's a spoiler. They're all goalies. Mm. So this is the franchise goalie edition. CC, I have five questions here. You need three to get the dub. Are you ready?
Yes. I think I lost the last edition of this quiz. So
you did.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right. First up, the all-time leader in wins for goalies for the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins. Is it A, Brad Thiessen, B, John Curry, or C, Tristan Jarry?
Let's say Brad Thiessen, A, final answer.
Oh, we're not off to good starts here, CeCe. It is, in fact, John Curry.
Mm. Great.
I wish I had a sound effect.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah.
All right. Next up, the all-time leader for the Utica Comets, which is obviously including their Vancouver history here, in games played by a goalie. Is it A, Thatcher Demko, B, Richard Bachman, or C, Joe Canada?
Joe Canada? Like
that is not a Canadian Snoopy with sunglasses. That is a real person.
Is it C-A-N-A-D-A?
Correct. Like that's not a weird pronunciation. It is literally Canada.
Hmm. Thatcher Demko, Richard Bachman. I'm going to say Joe Canada. Why not?
Final answer.
Yeah.
Oh, 0 for 2, CeCe. You are... This has not been a quiz format. That we were looking for Thatcher Demko.
Oh, whatever.
Demko. All right. Who is the all-time leader in save percentage, minimum 30 games played? So there is a floor there for the Iowa Wild. Is it A, Kaapo Kakkonen, B, John Curry, or C, Alex Stalock?
Kaapo, final answer.
CeCe, you are 0 for 3. We were looking for Alex Stalock. Alex Stalock. It is funny, though, that John Curry actually is close on that record for a different franchise.
Wow.
All-time leader in wins for the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Penguins. In the conversation for all-time leader for save percentage for the Iowa Wild.
Interesting.
0 for 3. Would you like the last two, or do you want to just...
Sure. Put me out of my misery.
The all-time leader in games played by a goalie for the Texas Stars. Is it A, Jack Campbell, B, Richard Bachman, or C, Landon Beau?
I'm going to say Richard Bachman. Final answer.
No, it was Landon Beau.
Well, all my Idaho Steelheads followers are going to just crucify me on Twitter now because I'm going to blame this on not feeling well tonight. Like I am nursing a little bit of a bug. So let's just get this fifth question out of the way so I can go over for the first time ever.
All right. All-time leader in single season save percentage, minimum 25 games played for the San Jose Barracuda. Because Henderson Silver Knights records really wouldn't be as fun. They're just Logan Thompson.
Right. Is
it A, Troy Grosnick, B, Antoine Bebo, or C, Aaron Dell? Minimum 25 games played, single season save percentage record. San Jose Barracuda.
Season.
Grosnick, Bebo, Dell.
Well, I'm going to say Dell. Final answer.
We're looking for Troy Grosnick.
Wow. I didn't realize he played for the Barracuda. 0 for 5. Wow. My first 0 for. What a night. Episode 97. It was bound to happen. Yeah. You're bound.
You made it this far into all these quizzes without Nofer. Bound to happen.
It is bound to happen. And you know, and it's for the best, because if I was going to win this one, I was going to defer to you anyway, because this is a topic that's worth talking about. So Sean, you earned it. I didn't have to defer to you. You very well earned it. I put up a big old goose egg. So the floor is yours, my friend. Your untimed 30 seconds to talk about whatever you want starts now.
So last time we did this, I didn't have anything that I was angry about in the AHL, and now I certainly have at least one thing that needs to be addressed here, and that is the Holmstrom suspension for using a slur on the ice that was audible, that got caught. 8-game suspension. That's unacceptable. You cannot give a member of the San Jose Barracuda a 30-game suspension for a racist gesture and then give an 8-game suspension for a homophobic slur. Like, that's not playing on the same standard here. And to be completely clear, as I said on Twitter, you need to give both of them the same suspension, the 30 games. I still thought 30 was too light, but Hrabek also hasn't been back this season. I imagine the Barracuda are keeping that intentionally to not put him back on the ice. But Holmstrom doing that is, you can't do stuff, something like that, and then send the hockey is for everyone message. Oh, everyone is. No. And Rochester in the same way, who's had a pride night. That was a very successful night in helping them bond with the community that is not usually part of hockey fandom for stupid reasons, because these aren't welcoming environments. In those 8 games, he shouldn't just not be welcome back to your team. He shouldn't be in the facilities. He shouldn't be in the town unless he's chosen to stay afterward. That is someone you need to kick from your organization immediately, or anything you have said on your pride nights or your, you know, being a welcoming member of this community in Rochester, it rings hollow. You have a choice here, Rochester. You need to make the right one. You had a choice here in the AHL and you made the wrong one. What was the process like to decide that a racist taunt was 30 games, but a homophobic slur is only 8 games? Like, do you understand how that sounds? How that looks? Like, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine next year, when it's very likely that Luke Prokop will be in Milwaukee and he's going to have to deal with horrible things like this, I'm sure. And we'll be here to flip out about them too, because it's bullshit. But what kind of message does that send to him, AHL brass? What are you doing? This was an easy decision to make and you somehow fumbled it. Shame on you. Shame on you. That is it for the show.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for watching or listening. The Calder Farmstead is part of the Full Press Radio Network. You can listen to this and several other great hockey, sports, and sports entertainment programs at www.fullpresscoverage.com. Just click on the podcast drop-down menu and in the top right portion of the website and enjoy.
And if you guys are enjoying the Calder Farmstead, please make sure you subscribe so you can get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon, or any other podcast platform, please rate and review our podcast. Or if you're watching it on YouTube, like the video, comment on what you thought of the episode, and of course, subscribe. Doing so helps others find the show, and your reviews help us improve it. You can also follow the show on social media at Calder Farmstead on Twitter, at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. Links to all of that and more can be found in our link tree, which is linktr.ee/The Calder Farmstead. If you're watching on video, it's scrolling below. Big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That is AD_DYSFUNCTION. So he can make music for you too. Sean, where can the people find you?
I'm Sean O'Brien. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That's SeanO'Brien81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. If you're looking at SeanO'Brien81 on Instagram, that's a different guy. My Instagram is mostly pictures of my dog Parker, as well as my Instagram story most days is the jersey of the day, which kind of helps showcase the wild collection of jerseys that I have, which I think is now over 70. You can find all of my stats work, including the model that predicts these games better than us, as well as all the graphs and stuff you see on a regular basis from my Twitter account and our Calder Farmstead account. You can find all of that at bit.ly/datadumpandchase, all lowercase, all one word. CeCe, where can the people find you?
Well, my name is CeCe Hockley. You can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at FPC_AHL and at my personal Twitter account at CeCe Hawk. That's SeeCeHawk. Mainly tweeting about hockey. If you were following along on Friday night, I was at the Bakersfield at Colorado game, that 4-1 victory that the Eagles pulled out. But I tweet about pro wrestling. I tweet about classic rock, films, my Wordle scores. So hopefully, if it keeps me interested, it's not going to be bullshit for you. Check out my writing on the Full Press Coverage Network at fullpresshockey.com. Sean, I don't know. I don't have a swing mic like you do, but I'll take my pop filter off and I'll say, Mr. O'Brien, take us home.
For CeCe Hockley, I am Sean O'Brien. Thank you for tuning in. And as always, please dump and chase responsibly.